Testing. This tape is tape one, side one, of an interview with Mr. Roger Hurl, the Chief Executive Officer of Occidental Chemical Company, headquartered in Dallas. The interview is taking place in Dallas at the Bent Tree Country Club on January 29, 1999. The interviewer is James G. Trainum. Mr. Hurl, I know from things I've read that you were born in 1931 in Iowa. Could you identify exactly where in Iowa you were born? Tell me something about your parents and your early childhood.
I was born in Bettendorf, Iowa, which is adjacent to a better-known city, Davenport, Iowa, and part of the now Quinn Cities area along the Mississippi River. My father was a postal employee. My mother was a housewife, had been a teacher in her career up until marriage. My father left the post office and went into what I would call a small farming kind of a occupation, where he raised cattle, had a trucking business, trucking cattle. Our family, both my mother's and my father's family, were farming people in Scott County, at little towns like Eldridge and McCausland and Long Grove, Iowa. And our family as a culture was a farming family. Basically, the area was, of course, a farming community, remains that way. And I think I would characterize my early childhood as, while living in the city, I grew up on the farm, because I spent a lot of time when I was not in school and on weekends traveling out to the farm, working on the farm, just enjoying the kind of a very open, relaxed lifestyle that was relevant to that era and also to a farming lifestyle. So some of the basic lessons that I learned in my life came as a result of being a farmer. And
did you live on the farm, or were you living in town?
Most of the time we lived in town. However, we did move from Scott County, Iowa, to southern Minnesota, to the town of Austin, as my father became a government meat inspector during the Second World War, beginning in 1941 late. And at that time we moved on to a farm, and I and my younger brother and older brother part of the time, along with my father, operated a 120-acre farm in that area. And that's during that period I actually did live on a farm, but that's the only period of time, for about 6 years.
Do you have any siblings other than the brother you just mentioned?
Two brothers, a younger brother and an older brother. My older brother has passed away. My younger brother is still living in eastern Iowa.
Where did you attend high school? Was that in Minnesota where you moved to? Or?
I attended, of the 3 years of high school, two of them in Austin High School in Austin, Minnesota. Then moved back to the Davenport area and finished high school at Davenport High School.
My wife, who is from Iowa, commented that she recalled that Davenport High School always excelled in debate. Did you happen to be engaged in that activity?
Well, I engaged in a lot of debating, but I was not in the debate team. No, I have had a love for debate and for philosophical and logic kind of things, but never got into the debate school or into the debate group.
After graduating from Davenport High School, what did you do then?
Well, I went directly to the University of Iowa and spent almost 4 years there. Was in my senior year drafted into the military in the Korean War, and spent 2 years, a little more than 2 years, in Korea, and then returned to the University of Iowa, where I finished my education in 1957.
During the first section of your career at the University of Iowa before being drafted, what was your major or particular interest?
Well, I was trying at that time to follow, I guess, in my father's desire that I become a doctor. So I was actually entered in pre-med, in a pre-med curriculum, and that's where I spent a lot of hours studying chemistry and the things that led me to, in some sense, to the chemical industry. But it was a pre-med curriculum and regimen that I followed while I was there.
When you returned from Korean service, did you choose a baccalaureate degree in liberal studies in order to finish quickly, or had your interest changed?
I would say it was a combination of both. I had clearly decided that I was not going to follow the discipline necessary to go through a medical education, and I guess, quite frankly, had lost interest in becoming a doctor and had more interest in business as such, and studied mostly marketing courses and so forth, and liberal arts. So that's basically went from a scientific discipline to a business discipline. That's where I went in college.
Was the choice of the liberal studies degree one that was available instead of a degree in business, or was it simply the choice that...
Well, it was, what should I describe it, was the most expeditious way.
Yes. To,
and I, at that time, by the time I came back from Korea, I had two children living in University of Housing, and by the time I finished, I had three children, so my interests were economic in nature, quite frankly, and times were different then, so yeah, I chose to get out as soon as I could and get into an employment situation.
How did you find employment very promptly after graduation?
Well, I had what I will call an interesting entry into the workforce. During college, children worked and actually had two jobs while I was there, one on the weekends and one during the week, and I worked for Skelly Oil Company prior to leaving to go to Korea, and then when I came back, they were beginning to build a cumene oxidation unit, phenol acetone facility down at their refinery, and were interested in getting an organization together to market the chemicals, and I was very interested in that. By the time I graduated, they had decided to market the products through a different method, so they encouraged me to go to work in the retail gasoline side of the business, which I knew from my work with them, after school hours and so forth, so I did that. After spending about 3 years in that, I decided that there was no future in that at all, and went back and decided to get back into the chemical industry, and in 1961 joined Bloxam Chemical Company, which at that time was owned by Olin Matheson Chemical Corporation. So that was sort of my introduction into the chemical business.
What was your position with that new chemical company?
Well, I that at that point in time, and for a considerable part of my career, I was in sales, field sales. They had a somewhat unique, at that point in time, sales organization. They had a single plant operation at Joliet, Illinois, where they made industrial phosphates for detergent applications, and had five salespeople that traveled the United States with large regions, and all operated out of the office building at the plant. So I traveled a good little bit. I part of my territory at that time was all of Texas, and went at I think this would be about 1963, they decided that they would blend their sales organization into the Olin Matheson Chemical Sales Force. I was assigned to move to Houston, and that's where I began my Texas career.
Where had you been living in that job before moving to Houston?
I lived in Joliet. All of the people that worked there lived in the Joliet area. It was a small company within a larger corporation, quite frankly. And,
you moved to Houston with the company, and in what way did your job responsibilities change
Well, really, the job responsibilities changed in that I had all of the chemicals that Poland Matheson Chemical Corporation at the time produced, and so I was selling all of the products other than phosphates, in addition to phosphates, I would say. And that covered a wide range of things, from selling HTH, which was and remains a premier product for swimming pool sanitizing, to soda ash, to sulfuric acid, and I guess the full range from what you might call consumer-oriented products to very basic commodity chemicals.
Was it about that time that you were developing an interest in management side of the business, or did that come later?
Well,
or earlier?
You know, it's seeking higher responsibilities and the desire to move up in an organization. I don't know when that happens, but I would also say that in my career of selling, it was never my interest to spend my career being a traveling salesman, and I don't mean that in a demeaning sense, it's just that that was not something that I wanted to do. So yes, I definitely had my eyes on the job of the man for whom I worked in Olin. I'll call him Olin Corporation because the Matheson name dropped later on. So in 1967, they asked me to come to New York, where their chemical division was headquartered, to spend some time as what they defined as a temporary assistant product manager. And I spent about 4.5 months commuting back and forth in a job as a assistant product manager. And at that time, what you would call industrial organics, the glycol ethers, glycols, surfactants, and so forth that Olin produced at Doran, Kentucky. That was, I guess, where I clearly decided that management was my interest in as far as the chemical business or any other business. And I felt some motivation and some sense of responsibility in dealing with that.
Once you had really sensed that goal of moving into management, did your work pattern change to move you in that direction, or was it just that you had been doing the right things all along?
Well, I'd like to say that I did a good job, and then since this is a temporary assignment, I returned to Houston, spent about another year working in field sales, doing some, I'll call it, non-official managing of territory assignments and account assignments and so forth, and then moved in 1968 to New York and now in Connecticut as a product manager for organic chemicals, and worked in that assignment for about 18 months, and then was given an opportunity to return to Houston as the regional manager of the sales organization down there, which was, in a sense, the first real management responsibility I had, where I was responsible for revenue generation for people and for sales office and so forth, and that was the start of a career in real management. I would describe that as beyond just product area management, and I enjoyed it very much. I think I did a good job, and if you want to go on in that, then I eventually was asked to come to Connecticut, which where Olin Corporation was headquartered, to become manager of, I guess globally you'd call it, but at least nationally, and sales manager for industrial products for them. Then became director of marketing in that field, and then took the real major step in my career, which was to become vice president and general manager of their industrial chemicals division. So I had P&L responsibility and responsibility for a segment of the company. And that began the career that I have ended up in, I guess, but we can talk about the rest of it if you like, or if there's some distraction you want to
make. No, fine. Go ahead.
Well, at that point in time, there's some career interest here that I've told stories to people about, that the young people moving up in management, that I think are important, because I very much enjoyed the position as a general manager of a large business. I have a little trouble remembering the revenue base, but at that time it was probably in the $500 million range, a fairly significant business, and one that was very important to the company because it was where we had our basic investments. And operated in that mode for about 3 years, and then was asked to take a position as vice president of administration with responsibility for human resources, for purchasing, for legal, and areas like that. And what I've said to young people, and I believe at the time, sometimes you get sidetracked, and your career in managing businesses and having product or profit responsibility, which you like, you get distracted into something like this, and you say, I don't really want to do this, but I was asked to do it by the chairman of the Occidental now, Dr. Irani. And for all the maybe different reasons, I decided if that was what they wanted me to do, I would do it, do the best I could. And obviously did a pretty good job doing it, and ended up learning a lot about law, about human resources in a broader way, the purchasing field and so forth. So it was a tremendous learning experience, not only from the standpoint of the content of the job, but the fact that sometimes when you see yourself taking a position that you don't want and seems to be a step out of line, if you commit yourself to it and do the job well, then opportunities come along again. And then I was 2 years later made senior vice president of Olin Chemicals, ran their chemicals business, and was in that position until I left Olin in 1983 to join Occidental.
Do you have a feeling that that assignment was in effect intended to be a learning experience for the grooming for broader responsibilities in the company?
As I look back on it, yes, I think it was. At the time, I didn't consider it that. I was very apprehensive about running the biggest segment business-wise of the corporation, and then suddenly being asked to take this, what I considered a sidestep and less significant position. But again, this is one of those things that you look back and say, I don't know what would have happened had I not done that, but I'm not sure that I could say that my career would have moved the way it is now.
Mm-hmm.
Someone else who would have been willing to take that on. And at that time, there was a number of things in the legal department that were very active with Olin Corporation. One of them that I might mention was an ongoing EPA litigation against Olin and others, but specifically against Olin on DDT sediments and, from their Alabama facility where they produce DDT. And we were engaged in a long, long, I'll call it negotiation, legal action with them over the DDT metabolites of the DDT. I got very involved in that, learned a lot about the products, learned a lot about what I'll call chloro-organic synthesis and so forth, and it was a really an interesting learning experience. And also got involved in a lawsuit filed against Olin and Niagara Falls for false reporting of mercury emissions from our mercury soil chloralkali plant up there. So looking back on that, I learned a lot about the broader aspects of managing a business and how you, the kind of actions you need to take, the kind of things that have an impact that isn't necessarily selling it and making it. And this was perhaps, what shall we call it? It was something that probably led me to a greater appreciation of responsible care when it became a paradigm of our industry. But I learned a lot.
Well, I was about to ask if you thought that that was the experience that led to your well-recognized interest in responsible care and environmental concerns, or had you had those concerns even before you had that particular exposure and those litigations?
I think actually prior to that, I probably had no sense of
no sensitivity
of the responsibility to it at all. No, that's absolutely true. And when you see the result of obviously the things that happened and so forth, and then obviously when I came to Olin, or I mean to Occidental, I get very much embroiled in Love Canal, so it was very valuable in dealing with the things that I had to deal with when I joined Occidental and eventually got involved in the Love Canal litigation and so forth. Tremendous learning experience.
You've taken us up to the time that you were about to leave Olin. Did you move from Olin to Occidental then?
In 1983, yes. I was at that time, I had become senior vice president running their chemicals businesses for the corporation. And given an opportunity to become president of Occidental Chemical. That was after 23 years of work for Olin, and actually for about 24 hours had two positions laying in front of me. One of them was president of Olin Chemicals and president of Occidental Chemicals. And in the case of Olin Chemicals, it's obvious a company I'd worked for 23 years, and you wonder what the future might be changing positions, particularly since the position I was offered at Occidental had three incumbents in 5 years. It was the Arm & Hammer revolving door situation there, but I guess in truth I had a great deal of confidence in Dr. Rani, who I've worked for directly now for 5 years in the administration role and in the senior vice president's role, and felt that there was more opportunity for investment and growth in the chemical business in Occidental by far than there was in Olin. So I made the change.
So
that was 15 years ago.
That was the basis on which you made your selection between the two.
It was
presidential offers.
It was truly opportunity as I perceived it, and it turned out to be an opportunity to grow a company as it has grown. But just those kind of decisions you make after a difficult one, but one that certainly turned out to be the right thing to do for me personally.
Well, certainly you appreciated, what one might say, the negative aspects of the change with the Love Canal litigation and publicity going on about that time. Did that seem to deter you, or did you sense that there was a challenge to correct the situation?
Well,
I
think quite honestly, although that was not the highest thing on my priority list in joining the company, being more focused on business than necessarily that, but in taking on the responsibility, one of the first connections I made, it was kind of interesting, the corporation's headquarters were in Houston. They had moved, Hooker Chemical and Hooker Oxy Group had moved back and forth between Western New York and Houston a couple of times, but they were happened to be headquartered in Houston at the time, and we subsequently moved them back to Connecticut. I met John Reardon, who at that time was vice president of what they called Hooker Industrial and Specialty Chemicals. It was the Industrial and Specialty Chemical Division. And spent some time in Niagara Falls, Buffalo area with him. John pleaded with me and said, look, the image that Occidental has in Western New York is that they intentionally created Love Canal, intentionally exposed the environment and human beings to these terrible products and so forth, and it's absolutely not true. And somebody needs to get into this and stand up and be counted for what was done, being the best practices at the time and so forth. And it, I guess admittedly, I took it on as a challenge and said, okay, we'll find a way to do this. And that became one of the most significant challenges I think I faced inside the company for at least the first few years that I was there. And while we were growing and acquiring companies and so forth, I never lost track of the value of resolving that issue, because as a member of the chemical industry, which is such an integrated industry, your reputation does mean something to your peers, to your customers, and to your suppliers, and I guess I decided that resolving that in a positive way would be a great benefit to the corporation. So I took it on as one of my personal tasks, I guess, to resolve it.
When you, with that resolve, as you went into the office of president, what first action did you take to meet that challenge and goal?
Well, the first thing I did, quite frankly, was to spend a significant amount of time back in the legal department, having had a history of dealing with the DDT and mercuries and so forth, and get myself knowledgeable about the history of this case, which was being handled partially by Occidental Petroleum's legal department in Los Angeles and by our own legal department in when it became Dallas. And my general counsel, who had been deeply involved in it when he was headquartered in New York and when he was headquartered in Houston. So I guess I took at least a year to really get into the bowels of what had happened, going back to the initial findings of problems with Love Canal and all of the issues related to the property and what happened and the deeding of the property to the school board, and really get involved to the point where I could honestly say, based on the evidence that I had in my hands and knowledge I had, that best practices were followed when disposed of waste in Love Canal, as well as others who were contractors to the government, as well as the city and county of Niagara Falls. It was a perfect solution to the disposal of the waste, and that I had irrevocably convinced myself that those actions were done with best practices in mind and with the objective in mind of keeping those products away from the environment and any exposure to people. So, having once convinced that, then we'd get into the laborious details of the case and went on and on and on. The most critical part of that was the punitive damages trial that was underway. And I guess that's where I finally concluded that I personally could take a major piece of that and do something about it, and pursued the subject of what in truth was done, the actions taken by management, by the corporation and so forth, leading up to the closing of Love Canal and the eventual deeding of the property and so forth. And I would say that I'll take as much credit as I deserve for eventually winning that case and having the judge determine that that we were not wanton and willful in doing this, and that punitive damages were not appropriate, because that was truly the turning point insofar as Love Canal was concerned. Because at that point in time, whatever Superfund related to, whatever Superfund became, at least it removed the stigma that this was something that the corporation didn't want and willfully. And I recall, James, in several occasions before I joined Occidental, people who had a bit of an arm's length attitude toward Hooker Occidental, because to use their words, this is a company that brought us CERCLA, Superfund. And, you know, what kind of a company is this? So my story is, during my tenure, I would perceive that Occidental moved from the company who brought you Love Canal to a leader in environmental health and safety activities in the chemical industry. I think a very valuable asset as far as the company is concerned. And that stands, in my own personal judgment, at the same height of achievement as building a company from $1 billion to $6 billion company, even though it has gone down as a result of some recent actions. But I consider that equally as important and equally as valuable as far as what I've done for the corporation.
I'm certain that looking back on your career with that brief summary, that that is a very personally satisfying aspect of it, that you were able to achieve such a turnaround in the image of the company.
Well, there are a lot of things that what I call create a positive employee attitude, and these attitudes and these kind of motivations on the part of employees extend out into the way they do their work and the way they interface with others. But the day that the Hooker Retirees Club in Western New York let me know that they wanted me to come to their annual meeting, because they wanted to tell me that they were now sufficiently proud of the company that they were going to change their name to the Occidental Retirees Company, because they didn't want the Occidental name connected with them in the past. And, you know, that means a lot. And people developed a sense of pride in working for the company. And, you know, people who are proud of a company and are proud of their work will go do things, and it extends into business and their ability to grow the corporation. So it was a real seminal event, although the other things are very important too.
Yeah.
Misunderstand me, I've started down a path here that you can tell is personally very rewarding to me, and one that's important to me because it interfaces business with the, I'll call it,
was there more on that particular aspect that you wanted to continue with, or do you want to switch to a different?
No, I think that's it. I might switch to one other thing, then we can go down different paths, because they follow a bit the same kind of an orientation, what I call management, and things that are important to managing people's efforts and so forth, and that is safety, which is the other side of the environment, health, and safety. The safety record of Occidental was not very good. I don't say looking at OSHA statistics or industry statistics, they were the worst, but they were not really very good. And it was my sense that if you're going to motivate people, if you demonstrate a concern for their safety and a willingness to invest in whatever, either management resources or capital resources in plants and so forth to make them safer, that they will tend to say, okay, here's a management that is interested in my safety, and you know, a greater respect for the management, because quite frankly, the respect for the management of Occidental was not very high at the time. We had our flirtation with Zoltan Mertzai, who, God bless him, was a great executive at Dow, but did not do well in Occidental, along with two or three others, and they seemed to be people who were interested in, let's say, less interested in the employees than they were perhaps in themselves or other things. But I felt it was would be a good thrust or a good strategy to work on the safety side of the company. And it had its rewards multifold, because we developed a process, if you will, of improvement in safety and injury incident rates and so forth, to the point where we, I think, where we are today, and number two behind DuPont. I don't know if anybody will ever get to DuPont's level, because they are really the leader. But we have a number of OSHA Star facilities in our plants. Our building here is the only building in the U.S. ever to receive an OSHA Star as a work site. And it's truly amazing how motivated people can be to compete for these recognitions as the safest plant. And every single plant in this company whose injury incident rate has gone down, their productivity statistics, their marginal income statistics have gone up in direct proportion to those kinds of things. So I found that to be a very good direction to take, and it's gotten to the point where we don't put less emphasis as management on it, but it's become such a part of our culture that people just do these things as a result of it. So that's kind of the non-business side, but it's critically important to the business of the company and the culture that we have here.
Did you initiate special training programs, or how did you bring about this very successful emphasis on employee safety?
Training programs, yes. Rather than leave the responsibility for safety solely to the plant management, and they had plenty to do then and have a lot more to do now, we put a safety organization in place where people professionally went out and did the typical on-the-job analysis of work issues, of the activity issues and so forth, and developed an, what I call, ingrained culture of looking at work issues of, missing a word here, in other words, what people's work responsibilities are, examining the job, is there a safer way to do it, and looking at all of the safety knowledge existing in industry as to how to make this job or that job more safe. And this safety organization, which has declined in size because we don't need it as much anymore, really developed a direct responsibility to the plant management or the location management, but a functional responsibility to a safety organization that built in what's now popularly called best practices and so forth in safety, and you know, just all of the things that go into focusing employees on working safely, and just worked very well. It's interesting that through these processes, including the environment and worker safety and process safety, that our insurance rates have declined rapidly, workman's compensation, and as well as the process and plant liability and casualty and so forth. That was not the objective, but it could get the benefit in that regard, and Our vice president, or senior vice president, executive vice president of manufacturing, has been asked three times to come to a world congress in process safety and process engineering and so forth that is put on by the casualty insurance companies to describe what we do. Another recognition, but that's sort of one of those things that comes with success, I guess. But it's financially rewarding. It is also a very positive employee motivation, and it's worked very well for us. I think it's something that clearly, as we look at these new issues of maximum exposure in chemical process areas and trying to think of the risk management planning that's now inherent in the future of all of our industry, that we'd be way ahead of the curve in this kind of thing. Because if you have to catch up with what is now the requirements that will be imposed on the industry for these kind of things, that would be very difficult to do if you're not equal to or well ahead of the curve, and we are well ahead of the curve in that regard.
It sounds as though you're saying that the changing of industrial practices is not so costly as it is sometimes claimed to be, that in the sense of deterioration of the bottom line for the company.
Well, hopefully I'm putting this in the right perspective here, Jim. It's kind of a case of pay me now or pay me later. You can either incrementally stay ahead of the requirements and stay ahead of the curve, or allow yourself to slip back and then have an event occur that costs you dearly insofar as the requirements imposed on you, as well as whatever the problem may be that develops as a result of it, and put in the capital and do all of the things necessary, or you can maintain it at a very high level. And that's more of a case of pay me now. And we take a sidetrack here and say that I've been asked several times internally in the company, why are you working toward achieving full compliance with the codes of management practice and responsible care? My answer is simple. Eventually I'm going to have to do this. Responsible care is nothing more than a roadmap for what you're going to have to do in the future. And if you want to wait until the future is here and then do it all at one time, well, that's one way. The other is to build in the whole system so that you're spending cheaper dollars today to get to the levels you need to eventually anyway. It's just a roadmap for what the future lays.
And also avoiding a lot of unfavorable publicity.
Amen. So we've digressed into a lot of other things, but very important. I'm sure you're aware of the things that are happening in the industry as far as the environmental agendas for everywhere from the radicals that we know as Greenpeace to just the regulatory issues that come as a result of being a highly regulated industry. And so they all, if everything was done in the strictest interpretation of the things that we hear are going to happen, I'm not sure the industry could survive in some cases, so we need to deal with them in a more proactive and positive way. I generally find myself preaching to the converted, but...
Well, it's good that your own employees in the various plants of Occidental are the converted.
They are. They are the converted.
Well, you've spoken about your innovation in these... company practices that led to and are continuing to comply with responsible care. What kind of innovations have you initiated or encountered in chemistry or chemical engineering in the plant, aside from the environmental regulations and the safety practices?
I need to answer that in a broader way than you might think. Occidental Chemical, OxyChem, in absolute frankness, is not an innovator in either molecules, creating molecules, or in what I will call new processes to either produce new products or in producing existing products in a more efficient way. We have tended to, in large part, by the processes, licensing processes and so forth, but recognize that those kind of advanced processes are very important to what we do, and therefore at least monitor them consistently as to new processes. There are a couple of areas we have to spend some time in and being involved in. One of them is the core of our company, which is a electrochemical production, chlorine and caustic. We have had a venture for 15 years now with Deltech Systems in membrane cell development of chloralkali membrane cells. We have four plants around the world that are based on that technology. So we have been, I will call, creative in the technology. We have not done the research on the membranes. The membranes have been, well, basically they're DuPont membrane technology and so forth, but the process technology and the cell development and so forth are patented by Oxitec, this joint venture of ours. We have done some, I'll call it process, continuous process research in our laboratories up in Grand Island on building molecular structures in chemical intermediates, particularly halogenated aromatics, where we aren't creating a new molecule, we're just creating a new process to get to the end molecule. So that has been, if you will, the innovation side of the company, but largely as a commodity chemical producer, licensing in technology. We have never attempted to patent our PVC processes, but we do have a process for converting VCM to PVC that we think would be patentable and licensable. But given the industry as it exists today, this is not something that is such new and remarkable science or earth-shattering science that and the growth in the business is not something that would justify getting to the point of doing that. But we will call it proprietary technology, which everybody has a little bit of, Jim, as you well know. And that, of all things, is the emphasis of our technological efforts, is proprietary process development of licensed-in technology. We think we're pretty good at it. I would largely say that many of our peers feel the same way. But that's been the technology thrust of the company. Just to reach out a little bit here, we are finishing up a multi-product facility in Niagara Falls to produce a lot of different halogenated organics, perchlorobenzaldehyde, perchlorobenzonitrile, a lot of intermediates that go into a lot of products, dyestuffs, agrochemicals, pharmaceuticals, and so forth. The chemistry is different, but we don't end up with a different molecule. Mm-hmm. The process is different by our innovations and so forth. But that's the way we work the, what I'll call the technology side of the industry or of our businesses.
The Occidental Chemical have a substantial research department or force? Or
I assume that you're a chemist.
I am.
Okay. In bench molecular work, we have about 100 people involved in that kind of work at Grand Island in Western New York. Total expenditure is upwards of $20 million, relatively small as a percent of sales or anything else. And that kind of defines, in a pure sense, what I've just described as far as the way the company looks at technology. Some of that work, by the way, is supports a very small environmental group that has, it's in the bug bank business of microbial reduction of waste and so forth. So we're, of the total $20 million, I would say 15 to 16 of it goes into what you would call research and R&D, the R part of research. And that's pure. When you get into these things, I know that companies tend to throw technical support and those kind of, if you want to make the basket bigger, you add a few things to it, but that's what I would call a pure research function for us. We did, by the way, one of our, let me take a little aside here, when I was at Olin, we were competing with Hooker for the business of producing perchlorobenzene trifluoride for Eli Lilly for Treflan, which was one of the most prosperous herbicides for many, many years. And Occidental developed a process that where we lost the business. I was at Olin, and I joined Occidental and found out why they gained the business, because their process was much lower cost. So there is, I guess really I'm getting around to, there are some things that we have invented from a process standpoint. How do we get from toluene to PCBTF? That process is an Occidental process. Mm-hmm. It is much lower cost than the other routes. So it's chemical. It's route some chemistry, not necessarily development of molecules.
Well, chemistry is in the process, not mm-hmm. just in the end product, of course. Well, would you venture a brief summary of what scientific innovation has come to mean to you as a result of your experiences in the company?
Well, with my experience in the company and in the industry, let's say that as we branch out into biological chemistry, the routes that Monsanto were taking and so forth, I guess if you wanted to extend it out into the real future, whatever you want to call it, future 20, 30 years from now, the processes that we now use to produce several products, let's say, are ones that clearly could be outmoded through biological processes. I'll define them broadly as I can. But we are not taking a direction of that type. I mean, we just are not in a position or have an interest in doing that kind of thing. The advancement of chemistry to new molecules, unless you broaden this into the CPI industries and pharmaceuticals and all that kind of thing. Answer the question another way. Somebody asked me, why did I join the chemical industry? Why did I get into chemicals? I believe at the time that I joined the chemical industry, it was a high-tech, high-growth industry, clearly classified in that regard, let's say 40 years ago. I believe it has matured as an industry, and while innovation is still critical to it, it is a scientific industry. In the world of today, I don't think you could take the total of creativity in science and say that the chemical industry is a leading edge of high-tech, high-growth industries. There are branches of it that are clearly interesting and rapidly growing and so forth, but rather than be new things that people use, they are different ways to get to an end product more than they are a new use for mankind, with the exception of, I'll call, the pharmaceutical industry. Now, if you take chemistry into the pharmaceutical industry, which is certainly appropriate, then that's a whole different world out there, because the development of these, many of these pharmaceuticals is incredibly interesting. We're getting to the point where we will keep people alive through development of pharmaceuticals until we find something that the end of life is unknown. So.
Well, they get to that point in time for us.
I remember thinking once upon a time, I don't know how many years ago, not too many years ago, Jim, given that my father passed away when he was 59 years old, but he fundamentally worked himself to death. I mean, he was one of these farmers and people who working 16 to 18 hours a day was just the way things are. But I said to myself, boy, I hope I live long enough to see the millennium. Hey, I'm expecting to live long beyond that. And I don't know what the life expectancy is today, but it's in the early 80s. And so I think we're, I'm digressing a lot here, but as we find more and more things that the environmentalists and activists say are causing us problems, whether it goes from ozone depletion to persistent toxic and PTBs and POPs and that kind of thing, sooner or later you can continue to find things that impact our life. And as we cure more and more things, then we're going to have to eventually find out that if we eliminate all of this, maybe there's nothing out there that shortens our life. But as we improve the length and quality of life, which is incredibly been beneficial in the last four decades or so, sooner or later you're going to find something out there that is either a part of synthetic development, or in many cases natural processes that is the real cause. More. And eliminate exposure to them. I know I'm bouncing around here a little bit, but...
Well, one of the topics that SCI is particularly interested in is your view on the future of chemical innovation. Perhaps that's more or less states your view on that.
Well, it does, in one way it does, Jim. I may be off the beat here, but let me head down the road. If the inputs to chemical processes, if the chemistry that is used, the input to chemical processes, can get to a point where there is zero out that has an impact on human health and the environment, through technology, through chemical innovation, I think that's the Holy Grail. Until we reach that time, people will always look at this industry as you make these wonderful things, but you also make these things that bioaccumulate and eventually kill us. If I were to say, again, if there's a Holy Grail out there, it's finding the chemistry and the process capability so that it's total cycle. Eventually, if you can get that, that's where I think that this industry needs to focus a little bit more than they are now. And I just noticed that Dow is doing some things with NRDC that is working on reducing excursions to the environment by raw material and process changes so that we don't have end-of-the-pipe controls and so forth. These are the kind of things that I think augur to the future of this industry, to find ways to create in the minds of the public the fact that we do these things, but in so doing, we do not create harmful things along with it. That's a long ways down that road, but that's where I think we would propose to go. Not down to what you call 2 or 3 parts per billion. We should meet those regulations, but those 3 parts per billion, somebody is saying bioaccumulates and eventually is going to kill us.
You have already identified management agendas that you have articulated since you've come to Occidental with the responsible care or the environmental concerns and the safety concerns. Mm-hmm. Are there other management agendas that have changed or emerged during your tenure that you would like to speak about?
We could probably spend a lot of the rest of the day talking about what I call the economic investment side of the business, and since we're talking in a scientific area here, I think it's, but it is something that obviously I, of my day job, which is CEO of this company, I increasingly spend time dealing with the economic issues facing the chemical industry, Occidental Chemical, and Occidental Petroleum as a director of the corporation. And let's start with a statement I made at a meeting with I don't know what it was, or the SCI meeting or the petrochemical industry in Europe, where we were debating what's different in Europe, U.S. industry, European industry, and that is the quarterly results orientation. And as time goes on, increasingly, the value of companies is clearly based on our ability to attract capital to grow our business. And our industry is, industry in total, but certainly our industry is under heavy pressure to justify investment in this industry by shareholders or by any private sources or whatever you wish. We have developed, I think, an incredible capability to build and operate highly efficient facilities, the scale of which increases every time we find a new benchmark, so that what was defined as a segmented industry with very cyclical products like petrochemicals and olefins and far less cyclical products as specialties, whatever you define them, the industry's ability to identify higher value-added products and less cyclical products has gotten to the point where there are a decreasing number of true specialty areas where investments attracted not only in the capital but in investment in the company. And I think we have to face up to the fact that as our products mature and as this industry becomes more subject to the cycles, economic cycles and investment cycles, that we have to deal with that as an industry. And I'm very much faced with that as a company, and investing and managing the investments we now have. But if we're going to grow as an industry, whether that's to attract research funds or investment funds and capital additions and so forth, we're going to have to attract investment capital to this industry. And it's something that we don't spend a lot of time talking about because we are so obsessed with the environmental issues, and we are, of course, very dedicated to, I think, a scientific discipline. But in the real world that I live in, more of my time is spent dealing with funds that are invested in Occidental. Security analysts want to know why this and that and so forth. Why should we recommend investment in Occidental while it's very low in the industry? What is this industry becoming? Is it becoming an industry that can attract capital, that can attract investment? And I think that's something that most everyone is faced with as a company. But you can expand that a little bit and say, is this an industry that can grow by attracting investment capital to it? How we manage that borders all the way from collusion, which is illegal, and not building multiple facilities of that size, to, let's say, a real recognition of what the demand is out there in the marketplace, what the real demand is, what the sustainability of that demand is, what the economic capability to sustain that demand. We have to get much further into that rather than say, oh gee, it looks like there's going to be in 3 years that the supply-demand curve will reach maximum capacity, so let's five of us build a plant. Whatever it may be, and each product that is more value added in this chemical industry, and the more we talk about it and the more visibility it gets, the more rapidly it attracts capital and continue to add facilities. I think it's just something that as a CEO of a company, as senior leaders in an industry, we've got to think about these things and how you deal with them. Each individual company does it on their own, Jim, but until we learn that we do have to justify short and long-term returns on investments and returns on equity to attract equity and capital, until we really recognize that that's a critically important thing, we're going to continue this. If I've got money in my pocket, I'll go build something, and then we'll worry about what the hell happens after we build it. Something that is very important.
Are these concerns that you're expressing intensified in the industry since you became CEO, or is it a continuation of the concerns that were always underlying the industry?
I think it's intensified, Jim. And I early on said that, and this is true, I think the ability to take a project from concept to operation has shortened significantly, even though the processes are more sophisticated and you know, the building in continuous process operation and all those things seems to be more difficult. You can get a plant up and running that produces incrementally more than its previous predecessor in a relatively short period of time. And so, you know, I think it's a case of, okay, let's, when we decide to build a plant, let's decide whether in real terms that demand is out there or not. We haven't done very good at doing that. Now, the Southeast Asian malaise is something that is either an unfair example of what's happening in the industry today, or it is exactly what I'm talking about. Who ever thought that growth could continue at double-digit rates in any economic region of the world? Why do we think that was going to happen? Never has in the history of man. So why do we think that? Well, I don't know why we thought it, but we did. And so everybody built a plant to support that demand, and that demand has gone to zero. So, you know, that's a massive.
This is tape two, side one of the interview with Mr. Roger Hurl on January 29, 1999.
I'm kind of circling the wagons each time I'm talking about this, but it we go from our ability to conform to regulation in the future and that kind of thing to the development of better science to create better products and so forth to the ugly economic realities of an industry within a broad array of industries and the need to be a more stable, a more higher return industry in total to attract capital and equity.
Do you find that the stockholders are more demanding for these types of changes in perspective early on in your career?
No question about it. What do they be? You can take the array of shareholder groups and those who exert the regulatory pressure on us to say, you know, we shouldn't be making these products, or, you know, and there are a number of shareholder groups out there from religious ethicists to environmentalists to you name it, on that side of it, to people who are purely looking at the return to the shareholder, but let's say economic value added or an industry. And you're sitting there with an array of industries and you've got an investing public and you say, which industry should I invest in? Stay away from the chemical industry. It's too damn cyclical and their returns are low, and, you know, there are specific companies that might look good today, but it's not an industry that if you're looking for deep value or long-term growth and so forth, that's not an industry to put your money in. Not something we want. It's kind of like being the steel industry of the next millennium. We don't want to do that.
You made reference just a moment ago to the financial crisis in Asia. Occidental Chemical has a number of Asian installations, doesn't it?
We have an aggregate seven, of which only two are wholly owned.
Yeah, those are joint ventures.
They're in generally in the vinyl and chloralkali and in the phenolic resins business. We have a couple of investments in what we call DeRes, phenolic resins and molding compounds. It's hard to describe what's happened. I've talked to my peers who have justified their investments and so forth, and we've all read all the papers and all read all the reasons for lack of transparency in the investing between banks and companies and on and on. It's hard to describe. It's really hard for me to describe what it is that has happened any more than it is for me to read what has happened to somebody who really knows what's going on.
Do you have any speculation about the future for Occidental's Asian investments and plants?
Well, the plants that we have, Jim, we have no desire to get out of them. We put the investment on the ground. They're not returning anything of significance. Certainly returning investment on a cash basis, but not on a full investment basis, just like many others aren't. Recently, within the last 6 months, I read, and read forever, but saw an analysis of a projection by several agencies, including Deutsche Bank, Technon, and a few others, who are, I think, considered knowledgeable people in forecasting economics, as to the number of years that they perceived it would take for various countries within the Southeast Asian region to recover to a consumption level equal to their consumption in the fourth quarter of 1997. And that ranged from 2.5 to 5 years, the average being about 3.5 years, altogether with some signs of recovery beginning in 2000, I guess, was generally the perception that you really began to see something from going from negative to positive. But reading that in depth and taking that against other things I've read, I tend to feel that that probably is the most intelligent assessment that I've seen of what will happen over there, but because it was based on events that have to occur in each of these countries in order for that to happen. And as you read and hear about what is being done, it tends to follow with the actions being taken in those countries, social, political, cultural, economic, and so forth. But that's a long time.
Are the Asian plants producing same products that U.S. plants are producing, or are there productions that are unique to the Asian market?
They are the same, fundamentally the same products that are produced here, and one of the things that one has to face is that they're, I want to make sure we understand, landed costs, meaning their input costs may be higher, but if you eliminate the transportation costs, landing a product on a particular, at a particular consuming point, their landed costs are, would be about the same, but their efficiencies are higher, because we're talking about plants that are 1 to 3 years old, so they're using the most efficient technology generally. I've got some side things to that I really don't want to talk about, but so you, you know, in an obscure way, you're looking at what happened to Europe once they recovered, and Japan as they recovered from the Second World War. All of what is there in the way of capital investment is newer on average than those facilities that, that we compete with globally. And we've had a rapid buildup of, for example, of chlor-alkali capacity on the Gulf Coast for the first time in many years. Those plants on a cash cost basis are very low cost because they're all the most modern, efficient technologies and so forth. If you load in the return on investment, then we can compare with older facilities because we're depreciated in this facility. But the point is, they can operate on a cash basis, cash on cash basis, at a lower cost than the U.S. producing facilities. And if all you're interested in making a cash on cash return, they're very efficient and very competitive.
Your activity is in academic chemical and chemical industry in general led to your selection as the award recipient of the SCI Medal in 1997. Could you discuss a little bit of about the award, the citation, its implications, and what the event meant to you?
Well, several people have said to me, and this is, yeah, I may or may not leave this in the interview, but why the hell didn't you retire? while 97 wasn't this most sparkling year we've had as a company and so forth, but if you take an A or get 95, 96, and 97, well, averaging those 3 years, very, very good years economically, and very, everything was going well and so forth, and here you have a medal recognizing you, SCI and so forth. I guess what I'm really saying is, yeah, that was a unique honor, which I'm very proud of. And I guess it meant to me that the investment that I've made in industry associations and working within the industry to honestly try to improve its credibility and its posture and stature in the U.S. and the world and as an industry, I felt like it was something that I was very proud of, and I appreciated the recognition. As you look, one of the things that I looked at was who preceded me with those medals, and that's a rather awesome group of people who have received that, as well as the Perkin Medal. So it is something that I will consider the highest honor I've received in the time I've been associated with the industry, and I'm deeply proud of it. And, I must say, humble to the extent of knowing there were others equally as deserving of the award, but I'm very much appreciate it. Very much.
On the occasion of the receipt of that medal, what was the emphasis in your award address?
Well, I tried to do it differently than Keith McKinnon. I used Keith's comment. Keith McKinnon was Dow Corning chairman at the time. And I've kept the analysis that was done in, I think it was in the Chemical Engineering News, related his speech, and I think it was something that said, I'm proud to be a member of an industry that has more done more good for more people in the world than any other period. And I knew Keith well at the time, and I very much admired him, but it was an attempt to say, let's focus on the things we've done well. Let's concern ourselves with the things that we need to do, but let's think about the things we've done well and take as much pride as possible in the industry as such. And while we think in terms of what we have to do and the things we need to do in responsible care and all these regulatory areas, let's also think about what good this industry has done for the public at large and so forth, and try to get some more positive balance in what we have accomplished versus what people think we are doing that's bad. And, I think I did at that time relate to
the Love Canal era, and how I felt about the people who were involved in Love Canal, and why they were people who were doing the right thing in the best way they knew how at the time, and we still are. But that was my intent, was to focus on the positive, recognizing our responsibilities in dealing with the detractors.
One of the things you did not touch on, recall just thinking back over what you said, is what prompted the move from Houston to Dallas of the company when you...
Well, we moved from Houston to Connecticut, Jim, and then back to Dallas. What prompted the move to Dallas was Occidental's acquisition of Diamond Shamrock Chemicals, who were headquartered here. We had a very small staff in Connecticut because the core of management was diverse. We had three operating units in Tampa, Philadelphia, and one up in Niagara Falls. So we were really a true core kind of a holding company situation. Diamond Shamrock, with all of their plants located on the Gulf Coast and so forth, and their headquarters here, they had about 350 people here that managed the operation in depth. And it was clear that the logical place to be from the standpoint of where our asset mix would be, and was a little bit, but far more, as with the Diamond Shamrock, the logical place to be was here. So we moved here in short order. That would be my favorite Dallas story. The people who worked for me in Connecticut, if they were to go to Houston, Texas, they would get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and fight the traffic to go to LaGuardia Airport, go through all the machinations of dealing with a typical New York crowd and all that kind of thing, and end up in Houston for lunch. If you live in Dallas, you leave the office at 10:30, get on a plane at 11 o'clock, and you're at lunch. Now, that's a appraisal of what reality is in so far as productivity is concerned. It just so happens that Dallas is here. It's a much, much better headquarters location than the East Coast for a company like ours in particular. So if, I guess, put it another way, if Diamond Shamrock were not in Dallas, we would have moved to Houston. Because Houston is truly the center of the chemical industry, geographically and asset-wise. Nearly 70%, maybe a little bit more, of our capital investment is on the Gulf Coast, from Louisiana down through Texas, and that implies a lot. So, very logical place to be. It was no small value to me personally, since my family lives in Dallas and Houston, and I have 10 grandchildren, and it's kind of nice to be here from the standpoint of a personal situation, too. And we are a very family-oriented group, a very close family.
The SCI Medal has won award. You indicated how significant it is to you. But I've noted from reading that you've gotten at least a couple of honorary degrees from institutions, Ignatius College and St. John's.
Mm-hmm.
How did you happen to be recognized by those institutions particularly?
Well, in the case of Ignatius, accidental supported a lot of activities in Canisius and Buckwell. We had a number of employees that were graduates of Canisius. We supported a lot of educational activities at Canisius College. And I think I will say that the Canisius College Award was more a case of what I did for Western New York in dealing with the issue of Love Canal. Because there was a stigma attached to Western New York also as a result of this. And I think by varying, if you will, the stigma of Love Canal, that Canisius chose to recognize me as somebody who put the environment and people and things like that ahead of necessarily a bottom line profitability, which is true. I won't say ahead of it, but an equal footing with it. And that was that. The other one was somewhat for the same reason, quite frankly. The president of St. John's University was for a number of years the president of Niagara University on the Western New York area. And we had some very, very involved dealings with Niagara University on the same basis, but even more in depth, because some of the environmental areas that Occidental was involved in were adjacent to the Niagara University campus and so forth. So, I think it's a case of solving the dilemma of the stigmas that were attached to that region, and even to the college itself was pretty much at the bottom of it. But it came from St. John's, because the president, who I became a very good friend of and still am, chose to give me the honor when he moved to St. John's. And I still personally, as well as the corporation, provides funds to St. John's Street College. It has the largest pharmacology college in the United States. I never knew that until I found out a little bit more about it. But I'm a Roman Catholic. I call myself a religious man. I don't care. Maybe this week not to go on the tape, but my life principles are very much on the line of family and moral light and so forth. Which you want to talk about Bill Clinton? We can talk the rest of the day about that. We'll leave that alone. But a friendship and a relationship and wanting to see a region that I think unfairly had been stigmatized, see the stigma basically removed.
You have made reference to your family members along the way as we talked this morning, but I'd invite you to focus on it right now to give a rundown on your family, your children, so forth.
Well, I have four children. My oldest son, who recruited me to Oxy, we have a family joke about that because he had worked for Oxy for, by the time I joined him, he had worked for Oxy for about 11 years in their transportation and energy marketing, what they called Oxy Crude Sales in Houston. And, I left them about 3 years ago, owned the business for himself. He's along with some investors making a couple of products that are in electronic areas, and I don't think of the name of it. It's something that you can set up your television set to allow only certain channels to be watched. So that, and also as a consultant in the energy industry with Bankers Trust and a couple of others. My daughter, who was the second one, lives in Dallas. Her husband is with Texas Instruments, and he's involved in materials management and in this information technology development with them. His famous SAP information process, he does work on that as well as in materials management. Number three is a son who works for Oxy Kim. He's in the engineering group. He works with the engineering and multiple plants down there in information processing and information technology section. My youngest son is living here in Dallas. He's actually now not working. He has a disease of the eyes called retinitis pigmentosa and is legally blind. So he's doing some work with the computer access, doing some things with the Nations Bank, which they've allowed him to do because he was working for them at the time. But he lives here, and that's the family, and I said we have 10 grandchildren, so a very active life, and everybody's healthy and everybody's doing well. So a happy father and grandfather, right that way.
How many grandchildren?
10.
10 grandchildren.
I've given my children all the admonitions that anyone does as their family develops that rapidly, but that's sort of the way it is. Eight granddaughters and two grandsons.
Are you and your wife experiencing the emptiness syndrome since you had four children to rear and they departed for their own family situation?
Let me put it this way, Jim. For the let's say the 2 weeks of the Christmas holidays, we had something between 12 and 20 people in our house. So the emptiness syndrome is not a problem. We have the three grandchildren, daughter and son who live here, so we spend as much time with the family as is appropriate. We're a very close family, and our children used to come up with some regularity, so no emptiness syndrome.
I've noticed from some accounts of your activities that you are associated with some, I guess one would call, volunteer activities in Dallas. Can you speak something about your involvement there?
Well, I've been on the board of the Chamber, which is a broad activity on the board and the executive committee of the Dallas Citizens Council, which is a more focused, proactive organization dealing with what I would call more macro issues in the city, including public education and public utilities. Development of various and sundry areas, low-income areas, and so forth, and the Dallas Together Forum, which is a branch of that, dealing with diversity and those kind of things. I've been very involved in what is technically called the Southwestern Museum of Science and Technology, or the Science Place. And that ties together my very strong dedication to science education, as well as just education in general. It's, I've been personally very active and on the board, vice chairman of that, and while my day job has caused me a problem in spending as much time as I used to, and it still very actively involved on the board of the Science Place. I'm on the board here. That's hardly considered a civic activity. We involve ourselves as a company in basically educational areas. One of the things that I say somewhat proud of is that we have been for 7 years have provided housing and furniture and everything else for the Susan Komen Foundation, the Breast Cancer Foundation. Somebody said, why are you interested in that? I said, well, I have 8 granddaughters and a daughter and a wife and 2 daughters-in-law. I'm very interested in researching that and trying to think of other things. Off and on, there have been a number of other civic activities. But
the Breast Cancer Foundation has given you an award, I believe.
Yes, a humanitarian award. My wife is very involved in it, and we personally support it as well as the company does. I try not to take advantage of the corporation's involvement for personal benefit, but we do a lot of it work personally with the organization as she does, and I do to some extent. But education foremost, and science and health, I guess, would be secondary, but very important.
Your own career in the industry was immediately preceded by a liberal studies degree, which is not the usual preparation for a chemical industry executive. Have you had the feeling that unusual preparation advantaged you or disadvantaged you, or was more neutral?
that's a little hard to answer, Jim, in that let me answer that in 2 ways. One, I think it gave me a broader interest as I looked at my future than to focus solely on, I'll say, chemical engineering or bench chemistry, so that while I respect the fact that these are very vital functions, to get focused to that, I probably wasn't prepared to be more narrow in my view of what my future was. And for that reason, I think it was a benefit to broaden the horizons and get involved in many other activities, including all the things I talked about with legal and things like that. On the other hand, there are times when I'll call a lack of deep knowledge of chemistry. I wonder sometimes whether I'm able to direct resources adequately without that fundamental knowledge of chemistry that sometimes is helpful in making decisions. But when you get to the place where I am and have been prior to this on a couple of occasions, you pretty much rely on the resources of other people. I've had maybe 2 or 3 times in my career here, people ask the question about how do you get the management of an oil company to understand the chemical industry? And I said, well, let's take the chairman, who is a PhD chemist and has 150 patents worldwide, and the president, who is a PhD chemical engineer. It's not hard to explain to them the chemical business. But since, as I said, we are not a scientifically technology research-oriented company in our businesses, I don't consider it a detriment. I am the gentleman who is leading our specialty chemical development, chemical intermediates development. Since my staff, let's say half of a staff of 10 people, have chemical education backgrounds, the other half have virtually none. So, starting back about 1.5 years ago, every other monthly management meeting, I had to do a chemistry lesson for us and the products that we make and the technology and process behind it. And I know several times we'd be sitting there talking about something and I would answer a question. How'd you know that? So, well, perhaps the lack of that education has caused me to dig deeper into what's going on here than maybe the average person was, because I don't want to be in a position where I don't understand what's going on. So if we're going to make I don't know how the hell we make it, what the molecules look like and so forth. And I do understand chemistry. I studied a lot of it. But to the extent it's possible, I always try to get a little bit behind it and understand what's going on out there. Sometimes surprises people, but maybe it's a case of I'm not going to get caught not knowing anything about what's going on in the books. If you think back over our conversations, and you think of anything else that you would like to add or expand on for completeness of the story?
Jim, without being able to obviously recount everything I've said, perhaps not, but if I could emphasize one thing over the other in my view of where the future of this industry, where we need to, where we perhaps need to put more intellectual investment, more practical investment and so forth, it goes back to the attraction of capital, the attraction of equity, the attraction of intellectual capital. I have 10 grandchildren, and would I recommend to them that they pursue chemistry, chemical engineering, career in the chemical industry? I don't know the answer to that, and I should. I mean, I should be able to say this is a great field for young people. That's it. That's as a little bit of a distraction from what I talked about in attracting capital and attracting investment. I think we should focus on attracting intellectual capital, getting the hearts and minds of young people. It's a little bit in a silly way, like why don't we have enough priests out there? We can't attract young people to get into religious professions. What are we doing about attracting people to join the chemical industry and the scientific disciplines of chemistry and chemical engineering and get into the chemical industry? We need to really give some very serious thought into how we portray ourselves as companies and as industries to attract the hearts and minds of young people into this profession. We are number two producer in the world of chlorine and caustic. To attract even a person already in the chemical engineering field to this particular business is not easy. And as we lose those who have an in-depth knowledge of this business and industry and so forth, increasingly we find ourselves sort of short of the talent we need for the future. So along with attracting dollars of capital, we need to work pretty hard to create or develop or continue an environment that attracts young people to this industry. Recruiting on campuses and competing with Amazon.com isn't easy. And perhaps that's not necessary as much. As a company, I can maybe circle a lot of what we've said here and say that when we were growing and developing as a company, and where there was a perceived growing future, we never recruited anybody. We just went to college campuses and recruited, but we had people in lines at the doors. Today's world, given a high employment level and so forth, it's increasingly difficult to attract talent in, I'll separate the scientific discipline, all other areas to this industry and to this company. Not a good thing for the future.
Anything more?
No, this is a great place to conduct an interview.
Well, we're grateful to you for making time for the interview and your schedule. I know it's been a problem to find a time when you didn't have a sense of more immediate obligations to the company, and I'm grateful for your arranging such a pleasant place for the interview and for adding significantly to the bank of interviews that are part of the Chemical Heritage Foundation.
Well, there's times when Arnold calls and I say, Arnold, I've done my bit, but I also know that if the industry is going to have a future, it's got to have a present and a past, and the past has to be recorded, and I'm kind of proud to be a part of that. So
we're glad that you are, and I think you've given some perspectives on the tapes today that have not been on previous tapes, and so it'll be a genuine asset.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.